I grew up in a place with the night sky above the farm every night. I was shocked to learn that people have never seen the Milky Way because I saw it every night of my entire childhood. And I remember laying outside and watching the Perseid meteor showers and, you know, all the stuff farm kids do because there's not much else to do. And I think that really got me curious about science.
Welcome to Called to Science, where we delve into the untold stories of the scientists pushing the boundaries of the life sciences. I'm your host, science journalist Brad Van Perdon. Today, we talk about perseverance, making science more human, and outlaws from the Old West. Hello, Aaron Tranfield. Your career and pastime of capturing images has spanned continents. From North America to Europe, and even orders of magnitude from the macroscopic to the microscopic. You've made stops in the US, Portugal, Germany, and Belgium, and you've worked in a variety of places, from NASA to consulting, and now as head of the bioimaging core at VIB. And in my opinion, your career is an excellent example of where the call to science can take an individual. Aaron Tranfield, welcome to Call to Science.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
It's really nice to have you here, to have a fellow Canadian here. We have to start right away. Both from Canada, both ended up in Europe. Where exactly in Canada are you from?
So I grew up on a cattle ranch in a little town called Oyama. I was born in the city of Kelowna, which is our neighboring big town. But for most people, they'll know Vancouver. So our big city was Vancouver. In Canadian distances, it was next door. But in European distances, it was about 500 kilometers. So
a whole other country away,
but it was our big city.
Well, this is really nice because I'm also from Western Canada. So actually, Kelowna is like right in between where I'm from, Calgary, and Vancouver on the other side. So I'm curious, cattle ranching, growing up in the small town, Canada, did you always have an idea that you would leave, that you would go abroad? Or how did that come about?
My career, to be honest, is an accident. I followed what I loved. I followed science. I followed curiosity. And it has led me to many corners of the world. If you told me my CV now, if you told me it when I was a kid, I probably would have laughed at you because it seems impossible to have worked at NASA, to have worked in Germany at EMBL, to have opened a lab in Portugal, and now to be here in Belgium. It sounds amazing. But really, it was all driven by curiosity, by science, by a passion for photography, which became microscopy, and just liking to explore.
Mm-hmm. And I want to get to some specific questions about photography and microscopy, but I want to stick a little bit to growing up in Canada. Again, small town. What was your first introduction then to science?
My first introduction, I was a farm girl. So we had cows and they all had calves every year, babies.
Biology.
And so biology in action. For a while, I wanted to be a vet, but there was one very memorable incident where our vet came because the calf was breached. And so the vet had to get up and reorganize the calf in the mum. She was a bit of a short vet. So she put on the long glove that they have, the vets, and she reached up inside the cow just as the cow decided to poo. It didn't end well for the vet. So I decided maybe a career in veterinary sciences was not for me after that incident. I'm quite tall, so is my entire family. So I figured I might avoid that. But still, I wasn't sure about being a vet. So for a while, I wanted to be a doctor, and doctor led to research. And here I am.
You had you told me off camera before we started recording that you also had a very interesting story about your surname, which I think is very Western Canadian. Maybe you could share that with us.
Yeah, so the last name Tranfield, there's not many of us in the world. And the family legend, I don't know if it's true or not, but the family legend is that my great-great-grandfather rode with the outlaw Jesse James in Kentucky. And at some point, Jesse James got himself into trouble and he ended up escaping to Canada, to the west coast of Canada, where we're from. And they all changed their names to have an alias. Jesse James apparently changed his name to Mr. Howard. And my great-great-grandfather changed his last name to Tranfield, and that's where the last name came from. So we don't necessarily know what our name was before Tranfield. So my family tree on my father's side is quite short because we we're stuck at that point. But I now have a suitable explanation for whenever I'm up to mischief that I have an outlaw in the family.
Well, I was going to ask, does the outlaw streak still run in the family?
There's an element. I don't think we're quite as mischievous as they were at that time. There are some great stories of them scamming the government and building highways, but not building highways, all sorts of mischief. I'm not at that level. I'm a mini mischief maker, but nonetheless, it's still there.
That's great. So moving then to your passion, your career, photography. It starts with photography. When did that start for you? Because I know for me, Western Canada, I grew up in the Rocky Mountains. The pictures are amazing.
Mm-hmm. I think it went even further back than that. So photography was an exciting element of my curiosity for science. So was space. That's how I ended up at NASA. I grew up in a place with the night sky above the farm every night. I was shocked to learn that people have never seen the Milky Way because I saw it every night of my entire childhood. And I remember laying outside and watching the Perseid meteor showers and, you know, all the stuff farm kids do because there's not much else to do. And I think that really got me curious about science. I was lucky to have a mom who was a teacher and an administrator at schools. And so she really helped promote the curiosity in science. So I started to do biology and chemistry and physics as I went through school. I learned very quickly I was a disaster at physics. I could do it, but I was not so good at it. Chemistry was doable, but not so interesting, but I loved biology. And I think that came back to the farm. And then when I learned I could mix it together, I could do photography, which I see as a form of artwork, combined with science, it was a match made in heaven because I got to put my creativity and my curiosity together.
I'm really happy you said the word artwork because it's something I had in my notes because I think that people outside of science would all agree that photography is art. It can be an art form. But I wonder how many of those same people would put microscopy in the same category. What are the similarities, do you think, between photography as an art form, microscopy, and would you describe microscopy as an art form?
For me, microscopy is this amazing opportunity to explore a sample or a biological question. What we can do, the way I describe microscopy to the community, to the public, is it's like flying in an airplane. As you start to get closer to where you're going to land, the little streets of the cities become bigger and bigger, the houses become bigger and bigger, and you start to understand the layout of the city. And then as you get off the plane and start to explore, you can go into the little nooks and crannies and see what's going on in the streets of the town. This is what we do with microscopy and science, is we're really diving into the sample. We're exploring it in many different ways. We don't just have one camera, we have many cameras, so we can look at samples in different ways with different questions. And as someone who loves photography, there's also this element of beauty. There's simplicity, but there's complexity. We can use colors when we do fluorescence microscopy, which adds the element of color and pattern, and it all comes together. I think it's art, but it's also a creative science, a creative exploration.
I think maybe people think of microscopy as simply just capturing what's there, this sort of faithful representation of what's there. But there is this other side of it where you're trying to tell a story, you're trying to highlight certain elements in that image. And this is where the staining and things comes in. So that's, to me, where the creative element comes in. Am I far off on that? Or?
No, and there's so many elements to it. So you've hit on a few key points. You're trying to capture something. Typically, we cannot image or we cannot look at what's happening in exactly the living context. So what we have is a case where you have to remove a sample. You need to look more carefully at it. You have to take it out of the context. Then the chemistry is actually very important. That subject I never really enjoyed studying has come back to haunt me because you need to understand the sample preparation chemistry. What are you doing to your sample to really preserve it well? And then the next thing that comes into mind is, how do you explore it? Are you going in by high magnification? Do you want to see all the little details? Or do you want to see something happening over time? That's a different dimension. Do you need to have something? Do you need to approach a project to see the time element, how a sample can evolve, how a a disease can change over time? What aspect? Or do you want to see all of those at the same time, which then gets really exciting and complicated? And that's what we do in the core facility. We try and mediate this adventure.
This is something I wanted to touch on with you, and we can maybe jump around a little bit in your career, but as someone who's working at the bioimaging, the core facility, you're not necessarily working on the same project all the time.
Yeah,
you're
that's
helping
the best part.
Exactly. Well, this is what I was going to ask. Yeah, you're helping all of the different labs at VIB with the different projects. So is that variety something that appealed to you right away?
I love it because my role and the role of my team in the bioimaging core is we need to understand the technology. We need to understand how to get the best out of our microscopes so that when the scientists in the VIB community or frankly anywhere within Belgium or within the world bring us a question, we can design the best experiment for them. And the variables we look for in best experiment are we're looking for the most reproducible data collection. We're looking for something that matches the budget they have, the timeline of the experiments they have, the nature of the sample they have. So it's multivariable. It's the question, but it's also all of the parameters the scientists have to work with to realize the answer they're looking for. So I really like it. It's the ultimate MacGyvering of preparing a sample, getting it ready, and trying to get the highest fidelity out of it, which I really like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for any younger members of the audience, you'll have to look up MacGyver. But it's really this problem-solving aspect as well. It's a puzzle. Each day is probably a new puzzle, a new challenge.
I've been running a core now, first in Portugal and now here in Belgium since 2013, and I don't think I've had 2 days the same. And I love that diversity. Sometimes it's exhausting, admittedly. I'd like a quiet, calm day, and that never seems to happen. But at the same time, life is never boring. We're always doing something, most of the time, fun and interesting.
So the idea of having that variety in your job, was that something that sort of always appealed to you? Because it seems like your career has, you've jumped around and done a lot of different things. So mm-hmm. Is that something that you would say intrinsically you need to have different challenges?
I guess so. That's how I got into the consulting after many years of running the core facility in Portugal. It was getting to a point where it was hard to evolve in that role. And I had an opportunity to learn how to teach scientists how to communicate better. And I thought, oh, that would be really cool to learn. So that's how I got into the consulting role. I guess at a time where the diversity in my existing position was a bit low. I don't know if I need the diversity. Maybe if I reflect back, I guess I do. It's a good reflection.
Okay. Well, because then I wanted to jump to your time working with NASA. It seems a little outside of the biology realm. So,
as a farm girl, how did I end up at NASA?
Right.
Yeah. So it's actually a very logical connection, but again, a complete accident. So I grew up on the farm, as I said, and at some point I decided I would be the first woman on the moon. There's still time potentially, but I don't think it's going to happen anymore. But it was a goal at some point. And I'd always loved space. Move forward a bit in time, and I went to do my undergraduate at the University of Victoria and then my PhD at the University of British Columbia. And I, one morning, was watching the news, and they had this morning talk show feature, as they have in Canada. And they were featuring this new school that was going to be hosted at my university over the summer. And it was the International Space University. And I thought, and what exactly is that? That sounds interesting. I still was a space nerd. And so I ended up going up to the public talks and learning about what this program was. And it's a program, it still exists, it moves all over the world, where at the International Space University, they train experts in space exploration in all different aspects, from human health in space, to law in space, to ethics of space travel, to, of course, systems engineering, et cetera, et cetera. And it was through going to this program that I first learned that there was lots of interest in having A, more women, and B, more biologists. And I had both of those check boxes completed. So I took 3 months off my PhD in 2006, and I attended the International Space University here in Europe. That was my first time across the ocean. I went to Strasbourg. And in this program, I learned that scientists were very interested in the health effects of lunar dust on the human body. So although it's a very exploration topic, it's still biology. And very conveniently, my PhD was looking at the effects of air pollution on the human body. Exactly the same methodology, exactly the same research questions, just a much more, sexy form of dust. So what ended up happening was when I finished my PhD and I had really looked at how air pollution affected the heart, I then started my first postdoc at NASA Ames in California, looking at how lunar dust affects the body. We were specifically looking at the eyes, the skin, and the lungs, because those were the areas that were most affected during the Apollo missions. But it all connected.
Fascinating. Yeah, I would have, if I would have had to take a guess, I would have thought you'd be working with the Hubble images or something like this.
I did some of that too, but only because I was a nerd.
So then you kind of touched on a little bit, but like, what is this fascination with space? Because to me, you know, that's the biggest scale. And then your career, your day-to-day is working on the tiniest scale.
But it's no different if you think about it. In microscopy, we look through an instrument, in this case, a microscope, and we explore the small unknown. In astronomy or space, you're looking through an instrument, in this case, usually a telescope, and you're again exploring the unknown. It's just on a much larger scale. But it's still that sense of exploring, of being fascinated by the unknown, about diving into the dark corners, if you will, in microscopy and space. So there's elements that match across it.
And now it's time to dig a little deeper in a segment we call Dare to Ask. So I'm going to ask you some questions that people would like to ask, but have never really dared to ask. And these are questions that come from the VIB community.
How tall am I? Is that one? Because that's always what people ask me.
No, I'll pick a few here for you. As someone who inspires other scientists, what advice would you give to researchers struggling to find their passion in science?
So I suffer from imposter syndrome, so I always find it slightly awkward that I inspire other people. And I would say to someone who's struggling that they probably also inspire other people. They just may not realize the extent that they can support the community around them. If you're struggling in science, I would always say, look for what excites you, look for what makes you curious, and follow that. And usually when you're excited, you will find your way through it.
All right. Do you feel that VIB's reputation adds extra pressure to succeed, or does it motivate you?
It has a reputation for excellence, and that does come with a little bit of pressure. A few people said to me when I came here, you did so many amazing things in Portugal. We're excited to see what you'll do with the VIB. And I thought, whoo, no pressure. But in general, I find the community just highly motivating. There's so much happening. People are enthusiastic. They're doing new things. It's an environment where you want to thrive.
What's the most memorable collaboration you've had so far with another scientist at VIB?
I've only been here 10 months, so this is a very short time scale to sample from. But if I can say, I think the most memorable collaboration, and I'm twisting your question, naughty me, is I think with my team. You know, coming into a new institute, learning how to integrate into a new community, learning all of the ins and outs. I couldn't have done this without the team of microscopists that were already in the bioimaging core. So it's not a collaboration on a scientific level, but it's a collaboration on a human level where they've really adopted me, they've helped welcome me, and they're really excited to try new things, push into new territories. I love this collaboration. I feel very lucky to work with the people I work with.
Excellent. Well, and you mentioned earlier that, you know, we need to make science more human. And I think that's one of the things that maybe people forget or don't see from the outside. You know, think of scientists just hunched over the bench doing their own thing, everybody on it. But it really is a collaborative process and can't be done without a team of support and all the other individuals that make it possible. So
exactly. We're humans. We love microscopes, but we're still humans.
That's great. If you're listening to this Dare to Ask and you find yourself with a question you've never dared to ask, let us know in the comments. And who knows, maybe your question will end up on the next episode. So when I was in grad school, there was this stereotype, belief, I guess, might be a better word, that if you don't become a professor, then you've somehow failed or didn't achieve what you're supposed to achieve when you start out as a PhD student. I disagree with that completely. And I think your career is an excellent example of all of the different things that you can do with a graduate education by following your pursuit. What do you think about that stereotype or that pressure that maybe some students might have that it's professor or nothing?
It's utter hogwash. Is that an okay word?
Yeah,
it's very Canadian. That's why I used it. So I don't agree with it at all in simple terms. I think science has evolved in complexity so much that we can't just have professors anymore. We need to have technology experts like we have in the core facilities, and their role is as instrumental as that of the scientists. Scientists are expected to do so much scientifically. They can't also be expected to be experts of all their technology, and that's where we really support them. Mm-hmm. I think it's a very complementary pathway. It's a very different kind of role. It's more of a support role than a role where you come up with the big questions, but I think it's an equally essential role. Science has a very steep pyramid. If you only count those that become a professor as a success, we are really discounting all of those people in the periphery who are as essential but are doing different roles. And I think I'm really glad to see that the field is evolving, the acceptance is evolving. We still have a little ways to go, but we keep pushing and we keep causing trouble. The mischief comes back into play here. And I really advocate that if people don't find resonance with being in a PI role or a primary investigator role, that there's a lot of opportunities to do other things. And it doesn't just have to be technology. It can also be supporting the writing process in terms of editors of journals. It can be in conference organization because communication is essential to what we do. It can be in outreach. The list is endless, actually.
Mm-hmm. So do you have any specific advice maybe for grad students that are, you know, sort of in that period right now where maybe they're realizing that, okay, professorship, that's not really what I want, or I'm looking for something else? Like, how did you said your career was an accident, but how did you end up navigating some of these waters?
I've always followed what excited me. And I think that's what I would recommend to people who are exploring where they want to go next. It's really important that we enjoy what we do. And we have the luxury in science that there's a lot of things we can select from. So what gets you excited? I admit I'm not terribly enthusiastic about reading papers all the time. It's not my most wild excitement in the evening. So I don't think I would be a good fit with an editor position. But for some people I know, they really love going through the literature. They love understanding different perspectives. They would be a great editor. So what are you enthusiastic about? How can you bring that enthusiasm into science? Because the more enthusiasm we have, the better it will be for the entire community.
So as we've mentioned a few times, your career has taken you to a number of different places. You were running a core facility in Portugal and then moved into doing consulting, which, as I understand, you still do. And then you came here to VIB. What brought you here to the VIB specifically?
So the VIB is known for its excellent technology platforms, its excellent scientific productivity, and it was something I just wanted to be part of. The opportunity here at the VIB was bigger than the opportunity I had in Portugal. In Portugal, I built and ran an electron microscopy facility, and at the highest, we were a team of five. Here at the VIB, I run a team of 10 people. I work with 10 people, and we do light and electron microscopy. We do both. So the opportunity to come here to the VIB would broaden the portfolio of techniques I could support. It would help me work with a more diverse academic community. And it was really just an opportunity to change. Sometimes when we stay too long in the same place, it gets a bit less exciting, shall we say. And the consulting I do in parallel, it's sort of my background hobby, if you will. I think communication in science is really important. We need to make science more human. We need to make it more friendly. We can do better as scientists in how we lead and how we work with people. And so I try and share these skills with other members of the scientific community.
So making all of these career moves is very exciting, seeing all of these new places. But is there a challenge to that? Is there a difficulty in uprooting every so often and then starting over in a new place, new language, new culture?
Absolutely. There's a lot of fun to it. I can send very envy-provoking messages to my friends back in Canada with things like, I just drove through 5 countries in 4 hours, which is obviously quite impossible in Canada. But it's not easy being an expat. You're far from your family. You're far from your community. Trying to find a turkey to make for a proper turkey dinner at Christmas is not as easy as I was hoping it would be. Figuring out how to recreate a classic Canadian pumpkin pie was a culinary adventure, I can tell you. But it's also the little things. You know, you have your support community, you know where your dentist is, where your favorite pharmacy is. As a girl, it's very important to have a good hairstylist. So all of these little things, every time you move, you start again. And that's not easy. It comes at a cost in terms of energy, in terms of emotional comfort, all of these elements. I started at the VIB in March, and I would say really it took me until Christmas. So we're talking 10 months before I had addressed some of these things. I still haven't found the hairstylist, so I need to do some digging. But, you know, the list is long. It takes time. It takes patience. And it can distract from your job because you're actually so focused on trying to get life working that you're not as focused on your work.
Yeah, well, I know what you mean. I specifically had the same troubles with the turkey and my wife with the pumpkin pie.
I have a recipe I can share. I wrote it down as a good scientist. I have a protocol with each thing stepwise, so I'm happy to share.
We'll definitely have to exchange that afterwards. In the background notes that I was given and in some interviews I read that you've done before, you were open about a riding accident mm-hmm. that you had that left you with some loss of mobility. Why was it important for you to be open about this?
So I had a horse riding accident. I fell from the horse and crushed my spine in 3 places. And as a consequence, I have partial paralysis of my lower limbs. I recognize how hard it is to be a scientist with a disability, actually to be a human with a disability. Our society is not always as accommodating as they would like to be. And I think I am at a point in my career where my voice has a bit of resonance with the community. So I find if I can do anything, if it can be a silver lining to this really challenging situation, it would be to help make this environment more welcoming for other people. I also recognize in a way I have a very privileged perspective in that I founded most of my career as a fully able-bodied person. And now with my disability, I can compare it to what it's like right. from the before and the after. So I can also bring that perspective to the conversation. And thirdly, I think it's a method of coping. I mean, I need to find a silver lining to this because most of the time it's just rubbish. But you know, I can't really justify staying in bed every day and moping around. So what can I do to try and bring a positive spin to it?
Right. Well, that was one of the things I had written down here as well is, you know, when these things happen, you can try and find that silver lining, which is difficult. It's definitely not easy or, you know, be stuck in the negative. Was that something that you had to work at as well? Or does sort of looking for the positives kind of come naturally to you?
I think I have an inherent tendency to look for the positives. And this, I didn't know I had this tendency before my accident. So it was an interesting exploration of me as a person in the process. But it's still, there are days that are just horrendously hard. And I have to pick up my, you know, my boots, pull up my bootstraps, as we would say in Canadian English, and just get on with it. Mm. Every day is a new day. And my mantra when I had the accident was accept today, but work to make tomorrow better. And I still fight with this every day. Some days are really hard, but it is what it is. Tomorrow is a new day. And says I, who was in bed last night at 8:30 because I was so tired after teaching for 3 days. So, you know, you just got to adapt it.
Yeah, well, it seems that your career and this problem-solving streak that runs through what you do kind of resembles that in a way. So did your experience in your career and all the different things that you've done help you in overcoming this challenge? Or has it informed you in new ways?
A bit of both. I definitely, as a scientist who understood a lot about biology, I knew sometimes more than I wanted to about what was happening in my own injury and my own disability and the reality of what you can overcome and what you cannot. People would often say to me, if you would just do this, and I'm like, the nerves are dead, my friend. There is no just. It's like, this is an end. So at times it was hard. You wanted to find the optimism, but you knew too much. But I think in general, knowing helped. And it helped me know where to push, when to push, how much to push. I say, though, feeling slightly hypocritical because I don't rest enough. I'm always trying to do too much and then I get myself into trouble.
So I want to jump back to microscopy and I have a couple maybe quicker ones for you. What's one of the coolest or most amazing things you've been able to capture in the microscope?
So it would be using a technique called scanning electron microscopy. And I captured this moment as my first experience in microscopy, actually. I think it's what helped get me so excited. I was studying the rejection of heart transplants in Vancouver with some colleagues. And I had mounted new samples on the microscope and they looked funny. Something was weird. And it took me a while to realize that what I was seeing was white blood cells covering the entire inside of the blood vessel. And we presumed essentially starting the process of heart rejection. And it was so cool to see this and so interesting to know that I was probably one of the first people to have ever seen something like that. I remember this, so this dates me, but we took, at that point, we didn't have digital cameras. We had film. And I remember finishing the microscopy session and going straight back to the dark room at the hospital and developing, I think, until 11 or 12 at night because I was so curious to see what I had managed to capture. And that was really cool.
Are there any upcoming imaging technologies, you know, that you see maybe coming down the pipe in the next couple of years that you're really excited about?
I love them all. That's a problem. It's like asking me to pick my favorite child. So I have most of my training in electron microscopy. So of course, I still love the three-dimensional electron microscopy. I'm very curious, although we don't have this yet here at the VIB. I say yet, hopefully. X-ray microscopy is an interesting technique that might open up new doors where we can see bigger samples, image in a different way. That could be quite interesting. I think where we will go with microscopy is creative combinations of different imaging techniques. So we call this multimodal imaging, where we take, for example, a form of light microscopy and we merge it with electron microscopy, or we take micro CT and we merge this with a form of light microscopy, where you're putting different techniques together. It begins to open up a whole new world because you're starting to combine. And then the options become infinite. How many different combinations can you come up with and how productive, how helpful are they in science?
All right. So again, going to the flip side maybe of that last question, because in science, there's always new technologies and everyone gets excited about the new technology and wants to race to use the new thing. I want to ask you about the humble light microscope, the one that we all used in high school on the bench. Could you maybe make the case for the stalwart that's been there since the beginning, the humble light microscope?
Oh, you are talking to a kindred spirit. You know, the new and the fancy is important, but we need what I call as the foundation equipment, the foundation microscopes. It doesn't make sense to do the biggest, the hardest, the most complicated things always. Why are we doing this to ourselves? Sometimes we can just get the answer we need with the simple, humble light microscope. So I would really advocate that as much in science that we need to think big, new, and fancy, we can't forget the standard, the foundation, the sort of boring, because often you need the boring to get to the fancy. So yes, I fully agree. Is that enough of a case? I can keep going.
Well, you've convinced me, but okay, you might be preaching to the choir, so I don't know. So before we finish the podcast, we always like to ask one final question of our guests, and it's the same question for everybody. If you were to encounter an omniscient being and you could ask one question, what would that question be?
That's a good question. I might very selfishly ask why I had the horse riding accident, because I'd be curious what exactly I had done to warrant all of this. But that would be a very selfish question. I don't know, actually. I'm not sure if I have a good answer for you on that one.
Oh, I think that was a fine answer.
Okay. Well, we'll go with that.
Aaron, this was a real pleasure to have you here on the show. Thank you so much for being here.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
If you want to hear more inspiring stories from our scientists at VIB, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. And if you liked this episode, be sure to leave us a like or positive review. It really helps. Thanks for listening to Called to Science.